I'm Brian McCreath at WCRB with Gil Rose. He's the founder, artistic director, conductor, everything for Odyssey Opera. Maybe not the singing, but Gil, it's great to have you here today. Thanks for coming in.
It's nice to be here. I promise I won't sing.
So, Paris and Helen by Gluck. You mentioned in your notes for this that it's a reform opera. So can you just unpack that a little bit? What does a reform opera mean?
Sure. Well, Gluck was, you know, in his day, was probably the most, next to Handel, slightly before him, and Mozart slightly after him, probably the most performed opera composer of his day. And he had two sort of distinct periods. One, the early period, was more based on what was called opera seria, which came out of the sort of Italian tradition. The characters were very extreme, less refined, less psychological. The plots in the operas were more, a lot of more murders and revenges and a lot more things we think of sometimes in 19th century Italian opera. But also the style of singing was quite different, and the music itself was different because the opera serias would feature the technical brilliance of the singers. So they would write what was called da capo arias, where they would have the aria, and then they'd have the repeat where they would embellish, and a lot of florid fireworks and high-flying vocal, you know, histrionics was the norm. And then at a certain point, Gluck had a sort of rethinking about opera, and he started writing it in a much more stripped-down way, where the text, the music followed the text and tried to convey the drama much more than this set numbers of aria and recitative and aria and recitative and duet and recitative. It was much more intermingled. There was more instrumental music. There was more a through line of the drama. Those were then called the reform operas. He had, quote unquote, reformed, and reformed opera in a way. And his reform operas were a big deal for composers of later generations. Berlioz and Wagner were very inspired by the reform opera movement, and sort of Wagner's impetus to create the through composed music drama comes really, you could trace it back to the Gluck reform operas.
So that sounds like a huge change, and the way you tell the story sounds like Gluck really kind of pushed this himself. Did he get pushed back from audiences at the time? Were they a little bit thrown off
by
this?
I'm sure that, well, the thing about audiences and critics of any era, yeah, especially in the opera world, I mean, I think that the knives and the arrows are out for everybody.
Yeah.
I think that the opera serias had their fans and their detractors, and the reform operas too. But it did become a kind of a thing that was in vogue. And then there were imitators, and it became, you know, I think reform is a really good word because it sought to, you know, preach a certain kind of gospel about the excesses of the opera seria era, and how Gluck's goal was to sort of elevate opera as an art form, to give it a less from its roots as a kind of a common entertainment of fireworks and bells and whistles to kind of lifted up into a higher plane of art. And that was the whole movement behind operas like Alceste and Paris and Helen.
So Paris and Helen, one of the really distinctive things about it is that the male lead is written as a trouser role.
It's maybe a
castrati at the time, but a woman now.
Right.
And why do you think Gluck chose to go that direction,
right?
And especially, what does that mean in terms of how we experience that character?
Well, the three leads are basically three sopranos,
yeah.
And the Paris role would have been probably sung by a castrati at the time, but it's still a soprano voice. So the timbre of the opera is different than I've never had come across. I'm not sure if I know of any other opera where the three leads are all three sopranos. There's not even a mezzo to be had, let alone tenor, countertenor, or a baritone. I think that, I'm not sure the reason dramatically, but it does create quite a special visceral effect for the listener, because all the sopranos are of a different ilk. one being much more coloratura, one more being, you know, pitched lower and more chest voice things. But they still are sopranos, and they get what the challenge for us, I think, was, and I think listeners will hear it in the performance, is that there's to distinguish them and to dramatize them in a way that makes you, even without seeing the show, know, you know, which character is singing. So we were very conscious about picking three different types of sopranos.
And I think they do. I think when you hear it, you can hear the different characters, and it is. It's so unique that, you know, this is a sound like almost no other opera.
Part of it is also that Gluck characterizes them in the vocal writing. Helen's music is more lyrical, and the Cupid character is, you know, more boyish and a little more swagger to it, and Paris is sort of an ennobled character.
Yeah. It's one of three operas from that season that were around Helen of Troy. So so how does Gluck's sort of take on this story compared to Strauss's and Offenbach's? I mean, what did he contribute?
Well, yeah, that's three different takes. There were other Helen of Troy operas that I looked into, Strauss's take on it comes from a very strange part of the story. It's Helen's return to Egypt, and it's the craziest of the three plot-wise. I think I was talking to somebody after the performance, and they said they were imagining how to stage it, because we did it as a concert opera, and all they could think of was like a sort of a Game of Thrones version of it. It's very extravagant and extreme, with warriors and dying. And the Offenbach, of course, is Offenbach's comedic take on a famous story. Everyone at the time would have known the story, but as Offenbach did, he imposed he used the story as a vehicle for satirizing and poking fun of characters and known public figures of the day, primarily Napoleon III and the whole era of politicians and famous people. So, that's one other take. And then the Gluck take is, in the style of the Reform opera, I think, an effort to find some truths in this idea of pure love. And, it's not done without comic touches. The Cupid character, pulls tricks on them and deceives them, and there's back and forth between Helen and Paris, but in the end they unite, and then they take off at the end of the opera on a journey together. So they all had different takes on it, and they all have different takes on the character too. Very much.
But the Gluck may be the most straightforward, here's the story.
Yeah, it's here's the story. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the things that you do that makes Odyssey Opera so great in terms of it, what it does in the community, what it does for opera, that you have these foundational concepts, foundational sort of threads that run through entire seasons, or at least parts of entire
seasons. Sometimes we do half and half.
Yeah. So 1920 is the Tudors.
Yes.
And a really wide variety, it looks like, of stuff going on here.
Yes, six operas. Let me count the languages. not so many languages, three languages. Different eras, very different composers. Camille Saint-Saëns, Pacini, which is even a name that's probably unfamiliar to many listeners. Rossini, which is a name very familiar to listeners, Benjamin Britten, and then two other names that are probably completely unfamiliar to people is Arnold Rosner, who was an American composer who died about 20 years ago, and Edward German, who is a name people don't know. But we often end our seasons with a light opera, an operetta of some kind, La Belle Hélène being from last year being a good example. Edward German wrote an operetta called Merry England, where all the Elizabeth I era characters, Walter Raleigh and others, partake in sort of a May Day romp. But Edward German, who he was Arthur Sullivan, as in Gilbert and Sullivan. He was Arthur Sullivan's main assistant, and actually conducted all the GNS operettas. Arthur Sullivan would conduct a premiere and usually never conducted again, and Edward German conducted. And then when Sullivan passed from the scene, Edward German was the heir apparent at the Savoy Theater. And he wrote many big hits, but this piece, Merry England, was probably the most popular English operetta from the 20th century. It ran for many, many years, and it ran in the provinces and to this day. People know in England, they know Merry England the way they know, like community theaters know the importance of being earnest. So, and then we also have Benjamin Britten's take on it, on Elizabeth I, which is Gloriana, which was written for the coronation of Elizabeth II. The Arnold Rosner piece is a world premiere, actually. This has been an opera that was written some 30 years ago, but has never been performed. But it tells the story of another tutor, Lady Jane Grey, who was succeeded Edward VI. Sometimes I have to stop for a second and think about the family tree.
Right.
But in the power struggle that happened after Henry VIII's son died, there was... You know, these powerful families, and one of them plucked a very obscure cousin who had been an obscure cousin of Henry VII, actually, and put her on the throne, and she had a 9-day reign, and then she was executed. So it's a very famous story, and it's quite an interesting setting by this really overlooked American composer, Arnold Rosner. So we're proud to present the premiere, and it fits in our Tudor theme. And then Rossini's Elizabeth, and then Pacini's Mary I, Mary of England. Pacini was a contemporary of Donizetti, maybe a little bit later, more in line maybe with Spontini as far as the dates, but very prolific opera composer. I don't know what the total was, but something equal to Donizetti almost. In the day, probably almost as popular, if not as popular as Donizetti, and a lot of these operas have been almost all of them have been forgotten. But Mary of England is, I think, probably one of the few that's still known. But it's a perfect example of an opera that's lost. The disappearance is not warranted because it's full of some fabulous music.
And that's the thing about what you tend to do every year, that there are these things that you bring to us that nobody kind of knows, but we find so much in them. But I feel like a lot of Odyssey seasons, there is one opera that sort of is an anchor of something that's pretty well known. And the closest it feels like in this season that comes to that is Gloriana. Was there something?
Maybe, yeah.
Was there one particular catalyst for this idea that got you started?
Usually these themes come from like one idea that, or actually probably two ideas that seem to be not connected.
Okay.
And then you realize there's a connection and then you build the rest of the connection. In this case, it was actually Saint-Saëns' Henry VIII, which was an opera that was always a fascination to me. I have sort of a longstanding fascination with the Henry VIII story and the six wives and the various novels and plays and things that have been written about it. And I've always loved Saint-Saëns' music. I had a composition teacher in college that told me something that stuck with me, and I don't agree with it actually in retrospect, but it was a funny story. He always told me that Bruckner was the world's worst first-rate composer, but that Saint-Saëns was the world's greatest second-rate composer. It's just... a funny thing to say, but
right.
But Saint-Saëns was an incredibly polished musician with a very long career, and I always was fascinated by his music. Now, people know Samson and Delilah, but he also wrote 11 other operas. Henry VIII was one that probably was, till after the First World War, was probably the most performed of his other operas. Most of them have disappeared into obscurity, but I always wondered why Henry VIII wasn't more of interest, because it was a famous story. Clearly, the music was well written, and we partnered with a distinguished musicologist, Hugh MacDonald, who has just published a book on Oxford University Press about all Camille Saint-Saëns' stage works, and he's an expert in all French opera of that time. Very much started as a Berlioz scholar, expert on Bizet and Massenet. And in his book about Saint-Saëns' stage works, Henry VIII has a whole chapter. And what we discovered, I always wondered what was keeping the opera from clicking, and making it, because it's a sellable title. people know, just even from Herman's Hermits, they know the name Henry VIII. So I wonder how many people got that. Right. I'm not going to sing it. I always wondered why it wasn't a bigger success. Famous composer, famous story, obviously strong characters, love triangle. It seems like, you know,
yeah,
it's got all the stuff. And then I went and looked at the piece a bit, and it seemed to be disjunct. And what we found out was, partially because Hugh MacDonald's book was published at that point, was that a large section of it had been cut out. And they took it out, most of it out, before the premiere. Whether that was against Saint-Saëns' wishes or we know at least he acquiesced. But we put it all back in with Hugh MacDonald's help. We worked from Saint-Saëns' autographed manuscript. And we put something like 50 or 55 minutes of music back in that had never been heard in public before. And having gone through the experience of the very long opera with all that music put back in, what I came to understand was they had made a mistake and taken out the wrong stuff. Because the real drama of the piece is cut out at the beginning of the third act, and other numbers are cut out. And they, in an effort to shorten it for whatever reasons, and I'm sure it, the Paris Opera at that time, it wasn't to make it shorter. One of the big sections that was taken out is a confrontation between Henry VIII and the envoy from the Pope, the papal envoy. Whole part of Act Three taken out. And it's some of the most profound music in the opera, but in that time, the tastes for the opera going public were tenors and sopranos. And it was bad enough that you had a whole opera where the lead was a baritone, which was not common. So the fact that there was this bass that appears and sings for 20 minutes in the third act, it got the axe, so to speak.
Wow.
And other numbers, too, and a very large, long ballet that was part of the tradition of the time. All those French grand operas had a ballet that at minimum would be 20 minutes, at maximum could be 35 minutes, and they were part of the show.
Yeah.
And they were part of the balance. And I think what I learned from doing the thing is that actually Saint-Saëns could balance a 4.5-hour opera. It wasn't just Wagner or Berlioz that could do it. Others could do it too. And if you take out some of the legs of the stool, it doesn't work. And I think that's why Saint-Saëns' Henry VIII has not been, you know, put in repertory, because the music, there's really not a dull moment in the piece.
Well, maybe now it will get more performances.
We'll see. We'll see what we can do about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there's a ton of the season still to come. So
yes.
So we're looking forward to it.
Great.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.